Do you want to learn how to invest, or are you an entrepreneur and want to build companies in the regenerative food and agriculture space? Or do you work in big ag and big food and want to really move the needle? We have developed a new video course for you. Find out more on investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/course or in the show notes description below.
Do you think that direct-to-consumer platforms always have to be small and cute? Think again. Today's guest works at a company reaching over 350 customers and selling products from over 250 farmers. They're all organic or in the transition towards, and now they're starting to figure out what regenerative means to them. This is a fascinating approach. First, they've built the scale with an organic, which is usually already much better than conventional, and they have the LCA's data to prove it from an emission point of view, let alone the taste, specifically in this case on citrus. And after having built this platform from both the consumers ready to buy long-term and be part of this transition, and the farmers ready to supply long-term, be very transparent and go on a journey towards better soil health, the company now is getting ready to really, really push further into impact. This is the Investing in Regenerative Agriculture and Food podcast, Investing as if the planet mattered, where we talk to the pioneers in the regenerative food and agriculture space to learn more on how to put our money to work to regenerate soil, people, local communities, and ecosystems while making an appropriate and fair return. Why my focus on soil and regeneration? Because so many of the pressing issues we face today have their roots in how we treat our land and our sea, grow our food, what we eat, wear, and consume. And it's time that we as investors, big and small, and consumers start paying much more attention to the dirt/soil underneath our feet. To make it easy for fans to support our work, we launched our membership community, and so many of you have joined us as a member. Thank you. If our work created value for you, and if you have the means, and only if you have the means, consider joining us. Find out more on gumroad.com/investinginregenag. That is gumroad.com/investinginregenag. Or find the link below. Welcome to another interview. Today with the Impact and Sustainability Officer at Crowdfarming. Welcome, Christina.
Thank you, Cohen. Super nice to be here with you.
And people cannot see the background, but you're sitting in your garden, I'm assuming. I hear birds. You might gonna hear some cars on my side because I'm not in a garden, but I'm envying you already. But let's start with the question I always like to ask. How did you end up focusing on food and soil, and what was the journey that led you towards that? Because there are hundreds, if not thousands, other career paths you could have chosen. And yet you're here joining the podcast to talk about food, agriculture, market, soil, and all of that. So what led you to that?
So I started with a career that was focused pretty much in social impact. I went with different organizations, traveled to Senegal, to a refugee camp, and then I studied a postgraduate degree along these lines. And then the last 2 years and a half, I went with an organization called McKinsey.org to Argentina to work in slum, to remake and reorganize their waste management system. And suddenly I learned how much it social impact had to do with sustainability. We focus a lot in recycling, in soil separation, and how much it had to do with financial sustainability, right? So I learned that the balance of these three was super important. And if we didn't manage the climate crisis, the social crisis was going to be huge. So that kind of drove me to the whole sustainability, to see it into perspective and not only the social part. And then I wanted to come back home and I learned about crowd farming. So I joined as a sustainability and impact officer here. Yeah.
And crowd farming, I mean, the word is already, I mean, you called the company like that. And of course, other people would say, we're also using the crowd for farming. But in this case, it's the company based in Spain. And for anybody, of course, I'll put the link to the website in the chat that maybe has heard about it or has never heard about it. How do you normally describe what crowd farming is? And then, of course, we'll unpack that journey.
Okay. So crowd farming is a platform that connects farmers, organic farmers, directly to consumers, and we're leading the direct sales market here in Europe. But on top of being this platform, we offer the services that farmers need for direct sales. So this is, we organize the logistics. We provide them the marketing and the digital experience service. We provide them a super specialized customer service team. And the agronomists are also at their service for everything that it's more into the field, but also in direct sales, like sustainable packaging and things like that. And currently we have, just to put kind of the context, we started 5 years ago in 2017.
Yeah, I'm laughing. Nobody sees it, but because I think many people are going to mind, oh yeah, I've heard of those models and they're small and cute. And in this case, it's not small and cute. So let's create a bit of the context.
Yeah, exactly. That happens a lot. So we have 250 farmers here in Europe, shipping to last year to 350,000 consumers across Europe.
And let that sink in, people. 350,000. Yeah. Yeah. That's 3 zeros, or actually 4 zeros. Yes. So that's a big group. Yeah, all over Europe.
Normally, when we talk about this, it looks for people, it's so kind of idyllic that people look at it as a cool idea, but it's actually happening, and that's kind of the magic of it, that it's real. And we have a model that it's, I think it's becoming more and more known, that it's the adoptions. And we have also, the number of this is kind of impressive. It's 270,000 active adoption. So this is a plot of land or a tree or an animal that a person has reserved the harvest for the following year. And they can go visit their animal, their tree in a real farm, for a real farmer in Europe. Yeah.
And then sharing that risk with the farmer, because if that yield is lower or different than expected, how do you deal with that? Asking a very practical question from
what we do is we have kind of a buffer. So we are committing with that consumer for X kilograms of harvest that year, knowing that the tree might produce a bit more, or the animal or the plot of land. Then that extra can be sold through over harvest, we call it, for example, so in individual boxes. But we commit with that person with a certain harvest. What we're seeing, that maybe we will touch on it on following questions, but what we see is, for example, with the drought, the yield has been reduced so much to numbers that even our buffer didn't cover, that what we do is we offer another farmer to get their that extra product from. So yeah, we're actually seeing that happening.
So you're building that buffer for, let's say, X amount of flour or oranges or... And normally, and I'm using quotes here, that would be enough, and the overyield might be sold to the same customer or to somebody else. But in these times of craziness and climate weirdness, as somebody quoted it, you're seeing actually that it's difficult. I mean, some crops, of course, depending where you are, because some people have had very regular spring until now, but most people didn't, especially Southern Europe. Then you need to source it somewhere else because you have committed to those kilos and to those boxes.
Yes, we have different scenarios. So we have that, and we have the one that you maybe plan to order in your oranges or your avocados till late May, even June, and suddenly you have to order them now because there's just no more harvest in the following months. So you have the volume, but it just harvested so quickly and so early that you have to order it now. Yeah. So that's the important, that's the relevance of a super good customer service team, that they are not only there kind of to solve shipment incidents, they're there to tell them, okay, this is what's happening, this is the context, and we are working with nature and with real farmers, and your product is waiting on the tree and not in a cold chamber. So this is why you have to wait, or you have to order in advance, because this is nature and this is what happens. It has its own rhythms, yeah.
And what are the main products? I mean, we touched upon a few, but I think you started with citrus, if I'm correct.
Yes.
And now what are you branching? Of course, you can look on the website. There's a lot, but what are the main ones? Let's say 80% comes from a few crops, or is it very, very diverse?
No, we have a lot of citrus fruit. We have also tropical fruit like avocado, mango, and a lot of other sub-varieties that are super cool, like passion fruit or pitaya or things like this. And we're very strong on those. And then I would say the third and fourth are seed fruit, and they are stone fruit. We have extra virgin olive oil as a pretty strong one. and berries maybe.
So most of them are perishable, which brings us to logistics. How do you organize that?
Yes. Yeah, so this is
because let's say the alternative, the supermarkets and distribution chain have been investing for a long time, first of all, and got pretty good at it with all the waste and the weeks in cold chain and losing a flavor, etc. But at least, unless they're strikes, but they show up very regularly. And if you're just a general consumer in a supermarket, you would never question that because it's just always there. How on earth can you compete with that?
So this is, I think, the strongest part in the difference between what we do and what we're used to as consumers, right? Because one of it is what happens on the field, and we'll talk about that later. But the second is what happens in between. So we're used to getting our products faster and faster, having everything we want in the supermarket until 9 at 9, having it all year round. And that's not reality, and this is not how it works. And what we have done is we are trying to change the mentality into your product, for it to be fresh and for it to be sustainable, it needs to be where it belongs, so in the field. And we will only pick it up from the field whenever it's ready. From there, what we do is we ship it, like our average shipment from all across Europe to all across Europe, it's 5.5 days from when it was hanging on the tree, is nothing, till it's at your house. So every time that the product is not on the tree, it's getting some kind of resources of energy to maintain it. So it's most products need to be in cold chambers to stay.
It will lose flavor. It will lose nutrients, vitamins,
and it will consume energy. Yeah, it will have different products to maintain it the way it is. And also a huge difference is the food waste, right? Because that we have all this kind of homogeneous food that it looks so beautiful and so shiny, they have discarded a lot that are not the perfect size, that have little marks from being on the field. They're out there, so they're going to get little marks from the rain, from a little bag for something. So all of this is discarded, and so this creates a huge, huge food waste. So these two, I would say, they are the two biggest differences. But of course, like becoming really, really good and really efficient in logistics is one of our biggest wins. The good thing we had at the beginning is the citrus fruit travels super well. Like it is a super strong fruit. But now that we're broadening our portfolio, that we're going into stone fruit,
berries,
it is becoming more complex. But thanks God, we have a lot more experience and we can deal with these new challenges now. We would get bored if we didn't have this, yeah?
You just had boxes that stayed fine forever. Yeah, it would be boring. So how did you, do you have your own trucks? How do you make sure you create also economies of scale there, because of course it doesn't make sense to send 6 boxes of oranges to Berlin and then 2 boxes to London and then another few boxes somewhere else. Like, how do you make sure it makes sense and not my orange is going to be amazing but cost at least 10 euros a kilo and that would just be unsustainable?
So exactly, it has been a journey. From at the beginning, we had to share shipments with other type of shipments. When you gain the economy of scale, you have a lot of different farms, you can kind of be very efficient in picking them up and opening dates for shipment and then get a full truck. We don't have our own trucks, so we hire companies to do the long hauls. So this is kind of the big trucks refrigerated with that they travel, like the average last year was over 90% capacity. So we try that every journey counts. If not, we put our packages, if they are like, imagine that we are from a very remote place in Italy, shipping from a farm to a consumer in Spain, we put it in a truck with other things and with other companies, right? And now that we have become bigger and bigger now in Spain, for example, that we have a lot of farmers in the area of Valencia, in Malaga, what we in general in the south of Spain, what we have installed from last year, a logistics center, so that we can kind of take out the burden of farmers of doing all of this direct sales, packaging, etc., assuming the cost now that with a lot of inflation, and they can directly, like we pick up the fruit directly from the field boxes, and then we manage all the rest in our logistics center. We also, that way, we provide them kind of the possibility to have more formats, because when you are a farmer, you can tell me, okay, I can do this amount of boxes with the space I have and the people I have, and this is it. No matter if I have more product, I don't have the operations to sell it to you. But now they can just give the product that they have, and we will manage the rest, yeah.
And just for farmers to work with you compared to, let's say, the big distribution and retail, what's the difference for them? I mean, I understand the adoption side, of course. I'm imagining there's some kind of pre-sale or at least commitment there to buy next year these oranges, or to buy the table grapes, or to buy the grain, etc. So that's one perspective. And in terms of price, what is it different from them? Why do you want to work with you and not with the big, let's say, organic retail that also exists in Germany, the Netherlands, and of course, the UK and the Nordics, where you sell a lot?
So I would say we have like three main ways in which we make a difference for them, instead of just selling to a supermarket. I would say one is the price. In a lot of cases, for example, in citrus, they get the margins they get through crowd farming have a huge difference to the traditional supply chain. And not only the price, but how it is built. Like at the moment in the traditional supply chain, like they start from how much is the consumer used to paying. That's not their fault. It's the whole system. We've made them used to paying this much. Then how much is going to, does it cost to have this product in the supermarket? How much are the intermediaries going to get? How much is the logistics? And then what is remaining? We give that to the farmer. Now we're doing it the other way around. We go to the farmer and they set the price, and they say, okay, I want to sell it for this price. On top of that, we put the services of crowd farming, of logistics, of the payment services, and the result of that is the price that the consumer is going to, the taxes in that country, and the result of that is the price that the consumer is going to pay. So that turns it completely around. That price that they have, that the farmer has set, remains for the whole season. So they know that if they sell the product that they have assigned to crowd farming, how much they're going to get. So they can plan ahead based on that. This leads me to my second point. It's stability. Like, it's not only about getting a very good price at the end of the season and it coming as a surprise. It's about being able to plan ahead with the money that you're going to get, so that you can say, okay, so I'm going to buy this to make things more sustainably. I'm going to hire these people. Because if you're not going to be able to plan, you just get the money, but you haven't been able to kind of make a strategy, make a business plan, okay? And third one is a little bit more soft or intangible, but it's a kind of the recognition for your work. Like producing something for a whole year with everything that it costs, the emotion you're putting to it, the family, depending on that, and then putting it in bulk with a lot of other products that maybe don't have the same treatment as yours, and the consumer just going to the supermarket and deciding based on price and the external looks, but because they don't have more information, it's kind of a super separate kind of process that when you join it, you can see really magic things happen between the consumer and the farmer. And they get the feedback, or the farmer tells us, like, I got this, I put this product, I take so much care of the boxes of crowd farming because I know that the consumer has chosen me, and not just a supermarket or a price. They chose me and my techniques and what I tell on my farmer page, etc. So that is kind of more soft, but it really creates a commitment, and people start to get to know the other side of the coin. Yeah.
And I'll put a link in the description as well. The journey of an orange you have on your website in terms of carbon footprint, the differences are, also speed partly in terms of packaging, in terms of transport, in terms of on farm and etc. If people want to unpack that further. And then, so where are the limits of this, in the sense of, you're seeing where we're going to the softer fruits, which definitely I think in terms of transport is challenging, but you're also doing pasta, or you're selling it, you're doing extra virgin olive oil, other non-perishable goods or less perishable. Where do you see the limit of, like, how much of an average diet or shopping can I get from it? Or do you see people saying, okay, I'm getting my oranges and my avocados and that's enough? Like, how do you see this going over the next, let's say, 5 years? Would it become a real, you are, but like a bigger competitor to traditional retail?
I think it's about both, like, us and crowd farmers or consumers, like, meeting halfway, because I think we need to offer more possibilities for them to get a bigger part of their daily consumption from there. And they have, and we as consumers have to change the habit. Like, we're used to, okay, I need an apple, I'm going to buy an apple to the supermarket and that's it, or order it from whichever online platform that brings it to me in 2 hours. Changing that perception and saying, okay, I'm going to get 2.5 kilos of avocados. How am I going to avoid them from going bad? Actually, there are a lot of ways, and we can do it, and you can plan ahead, and you can, cook around this. You can use your freezer for a lot of stuff. Like, there's ways to order bigger volumes and to plan ahead. But also, we have a lot of work to do from crowd farming. We have to offer possibilities to smaller households. We have to offer new products. We have to become as efficient as we can in logistics. So we have to. It's a thing much more than more products. It's about changing habits and us getting halfway to offer more ways of shopping, like group purchasing, for example, and things like this. Yeah.
And that group piece, how important is that? Of course, it helps emerging with distribution. And I see on the website as well, like, you always mention the next shipping moment, which could be in the next month or next months or weeks or later. Like, how do you nudge that social behavior? Okay, let's group it as much as possible. And let's make sure, let's cut away as much waste as possible and get to economies of scale also in that piece. Like, how do you make sure it feels like a community, even though it's me probably by myself on a laptop or on a phone, clicking things or adding things to a basket or adopting trees?
So we're trying to do this in two different ways. Like, one is showing that we're trying to, as the journey of the orange that you saw, that we just published it last week, so on Friday, a few days ago. It's like getting the metrics that allow the consumer to, and the impact report and things like that. We're trying to use these metrics and putting them in the consumer journey so that they know the actual impact of their purchase, right? Because we're telling them this is more sustainable, this is more fair, but seeing numbers and seeing kind of across all the community the impact that we're having, that is much more powerful, right? So that's one. We're trying to start inserting all of this impact in the consumer journey. The other one, I think, again, meeting halfway is not only because I want to have a huge impact, it's also we need to make the consumers see that ordering bigger volumes, for example, it's more efficient for them too, because it's going to be cheaper per kilo, and that is it. So we have to find ways in the experience to make them see the impact and the benefits for them. Yeah.
And on the journey, I mean, you see some of the farmers are converting to organic, almost all of them are or on that journey. What have you seen in the regenerative movement in terms of, you said an agronomist is also part of the team, and we is part of the offering and service to farmers. How are you going beyond organic, or how would you describe your farmers on that journey, let's say, towards maybe other certification or really like deep focus on soil life, which many organic are, but also many organic farmers aren't?
So I would say the thirst is not along a new certification, but it is on the path of doing something. Like, they, when you dig deeper, you see that, I don't know, the 7-9 practices, depending on who's telling the story of regenerative farming, that you see, some of them are implementing them because they because they want to do more. Because when that's something we really try to do, and sometimes it's natural from them, like this change of mentality of don't become organic just to have a certification and sell more expensive, but that change of mentality on why are we pushing organic and the conversion to organic. And when once that change in mentality has been done, the journey doesn't stop in the certification. You want more. You see you need to do more to retain your water. You need to bring yourself.
How do you get there? Like, how do you get a farmer and a farming family that has been doing things for a long time in a certain way and maybe became organic and swapped, let's say, non-organic inputs for organic inputs? How do you get that mental shift, or how do you assist in that? Because unless that happens, we can say all we want, we can send everybody to courses, but nothing really happens until somebody sees that potential and also sees that he or she has something to do there, or could play a role in that. There's some kind of that is not just nice for people in the US or people somewhere else, but it actually could also work in his or her field. Have you experienced that, and how are you trying to facilitate that?
So I think the change comes from one part, from seeing people value your methods, the methods like we ask. The onboarding process of a farmer is an average of 3 months. Okay, so this is a process in which they can have to kind of open their fields and their way of working to us and to the whole crowd farming community. So they have to tell us, what are you doing? Do you have animals in your farm? What practices are you implementing? What packaging are you using? Everything. Like, what are the workers in your, the workers' condition in your farm? Things like this, right? So, and that, the questions keep coming. We send an update to the crowd farmers that have adoptions on what has been new in the farm. They get the feedback from the crowd farmers. So all of this, like someone actually listening to your story and the things that you're doing for your field, and normally they love their field, they love their trees, and they want to see them come to life. So having someone paying a real price, you not being on survival mode, but actually being kind of stable and calm to, okay, the things that I care most, that it's my field and my farm and my trees, now I have the brain space to kind of and this someone who's listening on the other side to tell the story. So it can I think it's, yeah, it comes kind of naturally. We have a really good team, I said, of agronomists that really care about this and believe in the model. So they are also, like, for example, with regenerative, they're all the time kind of setting the seed in their brains, like, hey, there's something huge happening here. Let's start with it. So for now, it has been a lot of awareness in both sides. Like in the consumer side, we're trying to kind of start to get them to know this concept of what is regenerative and why we care about this. On the farmer's side, the same. We have kind of these four movements of Earth's Original Evolve, Tropiterranean, that it's tropical in the Mediterranean. We have conversion to organic, and now we have regenerative, that it's kind of in four key pillars, kind of raising awareness on, because we have kind of, we believe we know a lot in this four, and there's a lot of misconceptions, so we're trying to raise them up. In the farmers, letting them know that this exists. Now we've got to know a lot of organizations across Europe that are doing things in regeneration. We've talked with their farmers to see if they want to sell through crowd farming, and also kind of creating the demand. So we've been doing that, this kind of network and information and everything. But now we're starting a program of regenerative farming with some of the farmers. We are aiming to onboard on our first pilot here in Spain around 60 farmers on what is regenerative, kind of in an intensive course of 2.5 days. And then we'll continue with 15 with technical support and monitoring the results. That's super important for us, like kind of being able to bring these results to the one that is supporting them, so the crowd farmer, and also to the whole industry, because we need numbers to prove that things are beneficial for the farmer, for the soil, for the biodiversity, for water. And farmers in crowd farming are worried about what's happening and the changes we're seeing in the climate and everything. So they're like, what can we do? differently. And I think regenerative is the way to go. Yeah.
And we're going to double click on the water piece, but from the market side of things and creating awareness and the market pool, how ready do you think the consumers, especially the ones, of course, that are already committed through either adopting trees or buying boxes, for another term and more explanation and even more nuance and things like from a communication perspective, how do we make this accessible and sexy and interesting and relevant and not just relevant for soil geeks? What do you see there? Like, do you think that's easy, relatively difficult, or sort of natural in the journey? You have been already saying, like, look, these are seasonal products. It's better if you buy in bulk. These are the impacts you can have in terms of transport emissions and other things. Is this a sort of a natural progression? Like, let's also talk about soil.
No, I think it's not easy. Even like we have to see the differences between the ones that that process in the journey, in the maturity of the consumer, of the ones that are just starting to tap in this world, and the ones that are that really know.
You
that
must have everybody with 450,000 people. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so we are getting better at that segmentation and going to the ones that really like. There are, we have a lot of. Like farmers, small farmers in our platform that really know about this, that care, that they have, I don't know, gardening and things like this, that they care. And suddenly that's the way to enter this space. But it's not easy to get a new term. Like, for example, this is why we're making it very clear that for us, regenerative is on top of organic, at least in our platform. We think it's valuable that everyone is regenerating, and that's amazing. But in our platform, the basics is organic. And then from then on, we go into regenerative. That is that we, and we're super on top of making it sexy that you were saying earlier. I think that's super important to create the demand, because then there's no point of creating the supply on regenerative, or they will have to find alternative ways of financing this. That it's also valid, but. It's also about making it traceable and transparency. So it's not just about the term and making it sexy, but how do I believe that a farm that I'm not seeing is actually regenerating the ecosystem and having an impact in my life overall in the long term? So that's why we're super keen on the monitoring, and that they these farmers are going along, and it's not just about leaving things wild in your farm. You have to know a lot, and there's a lot of knowledge, a lot of monitoring, a lot of experience, a lot of machinery that need to go there to work. So we are super strict on the things that farmers need to comply for us to call them regenerative and sell as regenerative. Yeah.
In that sense, what I mean, you have a unique opportunity there, because you, unlike the other big distribution, you have already separated most, like you get from your tree or your farm, or you adopted that and it gets to your house. For many other players, it's completely impossible to trace that orange from tree to door. So there is a unique opportunity there. But yeah, and so what are you measuring? And what do you would like to measure? What are barriers there in terms of the impact, let's say, the outcomes in the field, on the farm?
Yes, this is why we're looking for a partner to do this with them, because I think there's people that, well, like you, that have been talking about regenerative for a long time, and they have the experience, and they are at the table with the big guys deciding on what's the future of regenerative in Europe. And I think that's the partners that we should be sitting at the table with, because we can start a system from scratch, from crowd farming, believing what's important for us, but we want to create a monitoring system that it's scalable. That's very important for us, because we have 250 farmers now, but we are planning on growing in the future. So now the measurement systems are super specific and quite expensive. So we need something that it's both precise and scalable. Yes.
Affordable.
Yes. So we're looking into, obviously, the typical things, the soil, the biodiversity, and the water. But we're letting the experts tell us which parameters exactly we should measure. The good thing is that we have a network of very reliable farmers and very reliable agronomists that work with us. So we have kind of the network. We need the knowledge of people that have been doing this for a long time, and that's what we're looking for, yeah.
And now let's double click on the water situation. I don't think anybody that lives in Europe, maybe even abroad, has not seen Especially on the Iberian subcontinent, it's been actually many places, no rain, very little rain, very little over the last months and the whole winter, and seeing temperatures, I think in Murcia, a few of your farmers are there, seeing over 40 degrees Celsius in April, May, which is very scary. So how are your farmers dealing with that? I saw an announcement somewhere, of course, there are no avocados anymore because of the drought. They're moving things forward, like you said, like suddenly harvest happens earlier because in a few months they won't be on the tree anymore. Has it been a particularly challenging year, or is it also more attention for this this time? Or what is your take on it being on the ground?
It is a particularly harsh year. It is, and our farmers are worried. We're worried, and the good thing is that it's getting the attention, and that is very good. The way we see it is, first of all, as I said before, and I told you at the beginning, I worked in waste management. So for me, that 30% of the produce that is being wasted, for me, it's crazy. And first, we should start there, like not wasting the resources to produce something that it's going to end again in waste. And second, I would say I tell our agronomists and our farmers that we can work in two lines. We can work in information. We can tell our crowd farmers like the techniques they're doing to save water. Where are they getting the water from? How much water is being used in their farm, therefore, in each kilogram? That's one part that we need to do. And another part that we need to do is, for me, this into solving the issue is regenerative. Like, we need to create soils that are able to retain water. We need to create the biodiversity that allows us to offer our crops to be more resilient. And I think it's the good thing is that we're taking one path that it's solving multiple issues that we're finding. Yeah.
And do you see, has that conversation changed over the last months as the crisis, the water crisis, has been making headlines everywhere? Has that changed, or is it really still on, we need bigger irrigation reservoirs, or we need support? Like, do you see the conversation getting deeper?
Yes, I think, like, we're seeing it in the news, and it's a huge, like, not only in the business, it's also in the news, like, it's this huge debate of providing water that it's non-existent at the moment, and we're seeing that everywhere. But it's also about, like, it's touching consumers' house. Like the other day, I was seeing in the news, for example, because they were now going to filling the pools, the dirty water that had been accumulated in the pool, they were going to reuse it, and they were like, people going to other people's houses and getting that water and using it for something else. So I think we're now in our date, like they're seeing that they're going to top the water that you can use now. Now it's affecting us in the day to day. I think that makes us super aware, like people that even don't believe in climate change are starting to say, I'm worried that it's not raining. And that is something that change of mentality. It's something we really need. Yeah.
Yeah. No. And then, of course, does it lead to other choices and other practices? Probably not fast enough, but at least a bit. And in terms of the role of money in this transition, also for crowd farming, but also for the crowd farmers, what have you seen? What would be your main message to, I always like to ask this question of, if there would be a room of smart impact investors, and we're doing this in a theater, and I would ask you, what is your main message, of course, without giving investment advice, but from what you've learned on the ground, selling these things literally to the kitchen table, what would be your main message for people working in finance, working to manage their own money or other people's money, of what they could do, or where they should dig deeper, where they should go and learn, where they should focus? What would be your main message to them?
I think look for people that have been doing this for a long time and that have the numbers to prove it. If you want to invest in this, you need kind of the validation, because everyone is talking about regeneration at the moment, everyone. And we need for it not to become this huge bluff, because there's so much power in it that it would be so sad that it goes to waste just because everyone is claiming it, right? So I would say go to someone go hand in hand with someone that can show the numbers and prove the improvement that is happening in the ecosystem. Go with someone that gets real, like actually, like this is happening on the field. So someone that knows how the field works and nature works, and it's not short term solutions. I would say, yeah, be part of the relevant decision tables. Like, there's a lot of things going on decisions on regenerative agriculture, carbon credits, things like that, and we need to set our lines or where we need to head in and where not. And perspective also. Like, you can fall in love with a certain farm that it's magic, but it's not going to make the numbers. Like, and it's something in crowd farming we need to see. Like, fall in love with the farm, the project, the product, but also think large scale, because we want to create a movement that has an impact. And for that, we need to be big and it needs to be scalable. So it doesn't matter if I see an amazing technology that it's going to save me so much water and it's going to give me amazing data points on one farm, on how one farm is improving, if I cannot take it to my 250 farms. Yeah.
Very good perspective. Yeah, make sure the numbers make sense in the current system. That might change. We might get ecosystem payments, etc. But we're now, for good and for bad, like, we're stuck with the current system, and the numbers need to make sense otherwise. And you're showing that there is a way to disrupt and to replace a certain part of your daily food spending directly from the farm, and in all ways better. And I think many people would have questioned that actually until they see the numbers and see the quantity of food you ship that would have anyway been shipped, but just in a very different way. It's not that you're selling extra oranges or things that you replace probably quite a bit. And what would you do if you would be on the other side? So not on the entrepreneur side, but on the investing side, and you had €1 billion to invest. I'm not asking for exact amounts, etc. I'm asking, where would you focus? Would it be, maybe in the measuring technology space? Would you invest in technology companies, or would you invest in the inputs, the organic inputs, in biochar, in trees? What would you put it to work?
I think aside, like, from doing what we're doing, but with a lot more power and more resources, like training, awareness. I would invest in pilot farms that really show that this model works, like a good farmer experience, a good farm that is working, and okay, let's prove that this concept works. And I think we need more kind of this middle ground between the two fields that I told you, like the farm and the being on the field and the huge perspective and global conversations. We need something like I would envision this kind of hubs, regional hubs that train farmers, that give them maybe the capex to go forward, like the machinery they need to go forward with regenerative agriculture, even livestock, like to keep the livestock and kind of use it for the different farms around. I think this kind of hubs of knowledge and capex and sharing spaces are to create community around this and create powerful movements, but local movements, it's super powerful. Yeah, I think that middle ground, it's I think the next step. Yeah.
And are you focusing on that, or are you, because you have quite, like, around a logistics center, basically, I think you're planning to do another one as well. They sort of naturally become those hubs. Is that some of your ideas? Because you have a concentration. Of course, you have farmers in many different countries, but there are some bigger groups, which also make things a lot easier. Are you focusing on that as well in terms of providing them more services, not quote-unquote just, because of course it's not just, but the logistics side, the packaging, and things like that?
I think we are starting a journey, not through the logistics center right now, but we are starting a journey of creating this community of farmers that has naturally kind of started, but now kind of with these trainings of farmers that work regionally, that have the same issues, the same problems, we're going to start seeing the gaps that there are. If there are gaps more than knowledge, that is a measurement, that is what we're trying to provide at the moment, but there's gaps in terms of livestock, machinery, etc., that we can provide or help bring someone in to provide, I think we're going to see it now. So we're starting a journey of creating kind of these sub-communities within crowd farmers, and detect those gaps that maybe make sense for us to chip in, like we're doing with the logistics center. Yeah.
And I always love to ask this question. So sorry, you're no longer operating your fund, but you do have a magic power to change one thing overnight. Could be in food and ag or in general. What would that be?
I think, as I said before, food waste is a big one for me. It makes me so sad that this is happening. It's not efficient financially or in any way. But I'm not going to go more into this because I already talked about that one. I think for people to actually see, I think it's beautiful to see how your food is produced. So kind of teaching people or for people to care and be curious about where food comes from, going visiting. So I would say if I could change things is that people, I will tell this story that someone told me that a kid in school said that the food grew in the supermarket. So I think this is something, it's pushing it to an extreme, but I think a lot of us believe that the food starts in the supermarket and it ends in a trash can when we put it out of our houses. And we need to be more curious about the whole system and how it works. And then if we care, if we get to know the conditions of how things are produced, the rhythms of nature, what's happening with regenerative agriculture, we're going to fall in love with it and we're going to care. It's impossible not to. So I think it's about curiosity. I would start this, this journey for people.
Curiosity. Very, very good answer. And where, I mean, I asked what are the limits before, but in terms of products, what are products that are high on your list or produce in general? It could be processed or, of course, directly from the tree or the field that you wish you had or you wish you had more of?
I think maybe the food that doesn't, like, I don't know how to say it in English, but that doesn't need irrigation. So I think that's a powerful and resilient crops. It's a powerful one for the future. Like, we're starting with a lot of almonds, for example. I think if regenerative wine would become more and more popular, things like this that work really well in places without irrigation, that would be a great one. And then some things that we are so focused on consuming local, but a lot of us have coffee, have chocolate and things like that. So bringing is in these products with traceability, transparency, sustainability, that would be a good one for me too, because the impact can be huge in all of the three terms that I mentioned in the beginning, right? The three magic ones, the financial, the social impact and the environment. I think if we get that one right, that's a huge step for us, yeah.
And are you working on that? Because I think I saw chocolate somewhere, but maybe it's made in Spain. Are you working directly also there again in South America?
Yes, we have a few farmers in South America and in the Philippines of chocolate and coffee. But it's a small scale at the moment, and I think there's a lot of people consuming that. And it's not easy to get it with that level of traceability that we can have at crowd farming.
Yeah. And beyond that, in terms of processed, I mean, of course, coffee is processed and chocolate as well, but things you're looking at or thinking about beyond the pasta made, etc. But like also there, you can add a lot of value to the farmer as well to process it properly. And interestingly, is that something the juices or like coming, of course, from the citrus background or other ways, the almond paste and all of that, is something that has been taken off or has been?
The thing that we have now is that we work like our whole model is built on working directly with the producer. So when normally when you get produced, many times you get many more intermediaries, right? So we're trying to get this one right, like working directly with the producers. And sometimes we do have juices, as you said, chocolate, coffee, I don't know, pastes and things, pasta and things like this. But because they produce it, At the moment, we're not going, like, we have so much more room for improvement in the logistics of fresh produce that we're not going to get into, for example, producing it ourselves. We're doing it with food waste. Like, we're doing chutneys and things like, and jams and things like this from the food waste that from our logistics center. But it's super small, but still we have some that, some fruit that cannot make the journey. So we produce, for example, mango chutney. Yeah.
And I mean, I'm asking this question, which is the final, but usually not the final, inspired by John Kempf, who works a lot with trees, but mainly in the US, and has his own podcast, and asks always where, what do you believe to be true that others don't? And he asks it specifically in agriculture. I like to ask it in regenerative agriculture, maybe specifically also in like the market spaces that you are in. So if you're with your peers, which are, there are some other platforms out there, maybe not the same size, but working on the same issues and struggles and opportunities, where do you think really differently compared to them within our own little bubble? I'm not thinking where do you think differently compared to the world, because that's clear, otherwise you wouldn't be on this podcast, but where if you are with others in your bubble, also within crowd farming, where do you think very differently?
I think at work I'm with very with people that
aligned,
are quite
people.
Aligned, although we have really strong debates. But
ooh, what are the debates about?
We debate a lot around carbon credits, for example.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
For me, I was going to say, but then you said kind of with your peers. Like, I was going to say in the overall and with the world, I would say that regenerative agriculture is not this kind of idyllic oasis of, hey, let's create biodiversity and the ladybugs are so cute. It's much, much more than this, and it is financially sustainable, and it's what we need for the future. But
I'm going to use this quote. Ladybugs are so cute. They are cute, though, but they're also very good eaters. Yeah.
But like, it makes sense financially. But I would say with my peers, I would say I'm super cautious with carbon credits. I think they can be part of the solution, but they can also be part of the challenges of the industry, and this becoming huge too soon. So I'm super cautious with this, and I need to read a lot more into it. Yeah. I think this is where
you
have the food fights. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting because I just had a conversation just before this call, actually, and somebody as well working very closely with poultry farmers and in a tree system. And also there, like, it could be very interesting because the potential, especially poultry plus trees and certain crops, is a lot. Like, the first research shows very interestingly, but then how do you make sure the farmer has agency and the farmer decides when to sell and the farmer and it's a tool in the hands of farmers. We always come back to that, and not some other speculative. And then there's the other side. We interviewed Rumi on this show, and we have interviewed Sekem, which should be out now as well, that they use carbon credits to basically scale, I'm going to get the numbers wrong, but I think to 40,000 farmers using biodynamic practices in Egypt without having to raise prices. So they say, we cover the premium of biodynamic and people can just sell for the same prices because we use carbon credits in this way. So, and then it's that tension. Okay, how is it used? Is there money on the table? Yes. Do we want huge polluters to offset their carbon and then we're all fine? No. But is there concrete money on the table now to get practices done sooner than later and get your compost and your trees in and your lines? And like, yeah, it's real money on the table. Then
yes.
I would like the farmers to have the opportunity to take it and do all the stuff they wanted to do and couldn't do until now, but then of course not be liable or stuck in contracts that we've sold to them already many times before.
Exactly. Yeah. And you
get approached for sure all the time by sellers and buyers and things like that.
Yes. Not so much.
But don't start calling people if you're listening.
We have a lot of conversations along these lines.
How would an ideal one look like for you? Like, what's an ideal, if we can just dream about, like, for your farmers, not for you, but for your farmers?
Around carbon credits?
Or would it be a broader one with, I mean, people talk about water, biodiversity? What would the ecosystem service-wise look like? I told you it wasn't going to be the last question. This never happens. It never is the last question. People are going to laugh now. Listen,
we're getting into very complex topics. Yeah, I think people are more worried on the initial part of the supply chain, that it's the farmers, I guess, and this carbon being real. I would say that we need to find a way that this is measurement and carbon is not always reliable, because things can happen that in 3 years, but maybe the farmer is doing everything they can and everything right. So I believe in, we have to invest in this change of mentality of the farmer, that it's a long term, and 10 years doesn't seem too far, because we need more than that.
You mean 10-year payment?
I think they need the payment earlier, The commitment of 10 years doesn't seem too far, because we believe in farmers that are really kind of doing the change in mentality, and they want their trees to be healthy. So they will do the necessary changes for that. I'm worried, and I saw this with the plastic credits too. I'm worried not only with things being done right at origin, but who's buying those credits. So are we doing things really well in one extreme, but not so well in the other one, so that people are compensating things for doing just things the way they have done it for a long time? And so doing an effort in one part and not doing it in the other one, I think it's not the good way to go. So my ideal thing would be not only to audit the origin of those credits, but I would auditing the end of those credits. Who are we selling these credits to? And can they do more to reduce their emissions before they pay? I think this is necessary. Or are they trying to evolve both ways? Like, we have this plan in the long term, and while we get there, we're going to invest in carbon credits.
And so would that mean then, looking at the whole Scope 3 discussions and large food companies, that starting to realize that there's a lot, of course, they can do within their processing, factories, transport, but there's a limit there, and they have to include their suppliers, which in many cases are farmers. So you see all the people scrambling now for like, okay, who are my farmers, one? How am I going to work with them, two? How do you organize that? Who are the technical assistance suppliers, et cetera, et cetera? You don't have that, of course, because you sell directly to consumers. So is there a way that consumers at some point become like, of course, very climate conscious, but also maybe buy some of their carbon credits through you? Is that a potential idea? I'm not saying it will happen, but because it's not that you can sell to a big orange juice producer, because it's not your customer. Like, it's not that those farmers are not in their supply chain, they're in yours.
So I believe a lot in not putting all of the way on the consumer, and in keeping the circles really as smaller as you can. So the crowd farmers are already doing an effort in buying.
They should be compensated for that. Yeah.
Yes. So we can find other ways. Like, for example, crowd farming has offices. Would we want to compensate for, I don't know.
It could be your own. And of course, exactly. You have a lot of your own logistics, like a big part of, I didn't read the impact
exactly.
report. I'm sorry, but I'm imagining a big part of your emissions come from logistics.
Or
the logistic companies.
Exactly. Can we work, if it is not us directly in our scope 1 and 2, because we have renewable energies and it's not, and bad old cars from our agronomist, we can put it in there. But can we work also with or logistic suppliers that, instead of compensating in projects in other parts of the world, in forests that it's not traceable, they invest directly in the farmers that they are picking up the food from? I think those closer and smaller circles can work much better. Yeah,
make a lot of sense. It's a very interesting one. And on the water side and biodiversity credits or biodiversity increasing credits, do you see any conversations that are getting more concrete, or is it still not really?
I haven't. No, not yet. I would love to see that. I think we need to start looking by the water consumption per farm and per volume produced, and see how we can get much better in this.
But in the water storage capacity. No. But it might be, I'm not saying easier, but especially measurement is easier, but also water quality, runoff. I mean, those things are relatively easy to measure compared to carbon levels in the soil. How deep do you go? Fluctuations, how many, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a direct thing. Like, if I reduce my water consumption on the irrigation side, or I do non-irrigated, plus I make sure I capture as much rain, etc., it feeds to my bottom line immediately. Exactly. Compared to carbon, which still is sort of this elusive thing that nobody has seen, unless you put it under a microscope. So that's probably much more, coming back to the communication piece, that is stronger, I can imagine, or even though somehow we made that decision in the environmental movement to only talk about carbon, and I think that's a mistake, to talk about it more holistically. And water, especially where many of your farmers are, is a big thing. And also actually where most farmers are, it is the big thing. Like, yes. Water, sunshine, and soil, that's sort of the conditions. And let's see if those conversations start to change. I haven't seen too much of it yet. Of course, some on biodiversity, but water storing capacity, like farmers being compensated for reduced floods and making sure, because of course we're living in this climate extreme, to store water where it's needed and to not release it when it's not, and things like that would be very interesting in certain regions.
Yes, I think we are going to be looking at all of this, even though if there's no market for them or for the farmers, but we will be looking at this because I think it's relevant information for the people that are supporting them, like the crowd farmers that are choosing them. So if you choose regenerative, what is the impact that these new techniques this farmer is implementing are having in the ecosystem? And then if they go and visit the farm, they're going to see the differences, because you can, like, that the good thing about regenerative is that you go to the farm and you see it with your own eyes. So that's the good part about the traceability part that we have going on in crowd farming. Yeah.
And then I promise this is probably the last question. Are you looking at quality as well? In the sense, of course, flavor, super important. In the freshness is probably the leading part, combined with what the farmer does on his or her fields. But in terms of measuring quality and looking at that, is that something you do? And looking at that nutrient connection to the regenerative piece, which is of course quite a big movement, or a big hopeful movement, let's say, within regenerative agriculture and food. How do you approach that in terms of the quality side and the measurements there?
So we had one kind of unset rule inside crowd farming until now, that is that we don't talk about the nutrients or the health in our products. We only skip this for extra virgin olive oil and the Mediterranean diet, but in general we don't talk about this. But now with regenerative, we're thinking, I have a biologist in my team at the moment, so we're rethinking this in open the conversation into nutrients, and if we can openly say, because we only say things that we're sure of.
Openly you say, have to start measuring first. Yeah, of course you have to do it internally, and
yes,
it would be fascinating to see from different years, different farmers, after transport as well, to see what it does with, and maybe, and then buy your average, quote unquote, average organic orange in the supermarket, or almond, etc., and see what differences are, if they are there, because it might be
disappointing. That makes a lot of sense. Not only in measuring it, it makes a lot of sense, not only measuring it on the field based on the different techniques, but also after the journey, and with differences of, I don't know, from 5 days or 4 days to 2-3 months.
I've noticed the differences with fresh oranges, having traveled 4 or 5 days max, compared to stored ones. I mean, the smell, if you open those boxes, is completely different from what you're used to. The problem is then you're spoiled, obviously. You cannot go back anymore. Everything else tastes like bland. But it's an interesting one to put data underneath that, and then what to measure and not to measure. It opens a whole new paradigm and world. But very interestingly, of course, because you're dealing with 250 different ones, and some, quite a few, are doing similar varieties or similar crops, you can start seeing interesting, hopefully interesting outcomes.
But it's we're not, like, in this journey that you saw in the blog, we are comparing an orange that goes from Valencia in both cases in the supermarket, but we have, I don't know, avocado coming from the other part of the world that has been picked before it is, or even oranges before it is ready, then it goes in maturing chambers. And this is a huge, this has an impact on flavor.
It's, of course,
it's obvious. So we need to see the way of testing these organoleptic conditions and things like that, and nutrients. That would be super interesting.
I'm looking forward to the infographic of that. and let's see what it tells us. So, and I think I want to be conscious of your time. And thank you so much for being here with us. Of course, the work that you do, but also coming here to share with the podcast your journey so far. And wishing you, of course, all the luck in that, and hopefully be checking in at some point to look at the regenerative journey and what you've learned, what you've seen, and who knows, some nutrient density data as well.
Thank you very much. Super interesting conversation. It was super nice to get to talk to you. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. For the show notes and links we discussed in this episode, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/posts. If you liked this episode, why not share it with a friend or give us a rating on Apple Podcasts? That really helps. Thanks again, and see you next time.